All righty. Well, thank you all for being here today. I am delighted to welcome to UT and to our class on Jesus in America, Professor David Morgan, who is the Phyllis and Richard Duesenberg Chair in Christianity and the Arts in Valparaiso, Indiana. He is the co-founder and the co-editor of Material Religion, which is the Journal of Objects, Arts, and Belief. And as I told you several times and showed you, he is the author not only of the book, but several the books on the visual culture of religions in America. And he will be lecturing this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Nationhood, Seeing Nationhood. And he has graciously consented today to help me out to teach you about the visual culture of Victorian religion. And he will be speaking to us now. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to, I guess, just put this. It's good to be here. My first time in Austin, so it's a delight. Delight to meet Howard Miller, who I hear much of fondly from one of his former students, who's a postdoc at Valparaiso, and to see Professor Holliday again in the art history department, and to be with you to talk about something I've thought about a lot, that is the role of images of Jesus. Why does this guy look the way he does to some people? And what is the cultural significance of his appearance? Why does he look the way he does? Everybody's got images in their heads, whether they're Christian or not, or what kind of a Christian they are, about this fellow. And the way he looks seems to have a lot to do with the way people feel about him. And parsing that, taking it apart and looking at the way the mind works with images, teaches us that images just aren't ancillary illustrations, that in fact they participate in the imagined lived life of believers. It's the way they put their worlds together. Images play a constitutive role. And I'm going to try to give you some sense of the variety of the way that happened in 19th century America, Victorian America. We're borrowing Queen Victoria's name to refer to this era of much of the 19th century. The remarks will follow this format. We'll start with Protestant and Catholic origins of modern imagery of Jesus. And I'm especially interested in the kind of crossover. They aren't rigidly separate. In fact, they borrow from one another considerably in the history of the United States. Then we'll look at something very important in the iconography of Jesus, and that is children's and mothers. Then on to, particularly to focus on Protestant visual piety, to examine how 19th century Americans looked at pictures of Jesus and how they responded and what they felt they were looking at and the power of images to be more than mere representations, in some cases, to actually come alive and to or to act like icons that open up a window to a distant past and enhance the reality of Jesus for many believers. Then on to a reaction against the prevailing visuality of Jesus in the 19th century, particularly in the middle portion and later portion of the 19th century. We'll find that the association of Jesus with mother tended to feminize him, to turn him into another Victorian mother. There was a reaction against that. A number of men felt that made Christianity unengaging for young boys, and there needed to be a concerted remasculinization of Jesus to make him a manly man that men will want to pay attention to. So we're in the realm there of not only of evangelical Christianity but also liberal Protestant Christianity. So the concern for gender ideals cut across denominational lines and across cultural distinctions. Then I want to follow that just briefly into the 20th century to show, in fact, how many Christians have two cultural scripts in their minds about Jesus, particularly with respect to his masculinity. Show you some images that I think are telling about this, and challenge the idea that the human mind is a monolith. In fact, it's more of a pastiche that can indeed entertain contradictory ideas very comfortably and does frequently. And then I want to end with a look at the uses of Jesus, the kind of the cultural appropriations of Jesus out of the realm of religion into the broader culture. What is Jesus' brand value, and how is he used in many different contexts? So this is going to be a gallop. I hope we've got 50 minutes. I'll try to end before the hour so you can have some questions or comments of your own. But just briefly, taking a running gallop, a gallop really at the reception of Jesus in the 19th century. Coming out of a Protestant background for most Americans in the 19th century, many Protestants of a Calvinist, of an evangelical background, are fond of assuming, wrongly, that Catholics are the folks that do things with images. We Protestant folk don't. Well, in fact, that's just not true. From the very beginning, Protestants in Europe used images. Martin Luther embraced them, felt that they were powerful tools for evangelizing, for teaching, for shaping public opinion. Almost all of his early sermons that were printed and circulated had pictures on them, woodcuts. People liked them. And Luther used this as a propaganda tool, but also as an instructional tool. And also, I would argue, as a devotional tool. So I'm just showing you, for instance, here, Luther and his patron posing on the title page of the German translation of his New Testament. Or above, this is Luther preaching. This is on an altar in Wittenberg, on the city church of Wittenberg. And he's preaching with one hand on the Bible, pointing to the other, and the audience there is listening, and hovering between them is Jesus. So in Luther's theological language, he is preaching Christ crucified. And we see then the neat collaboration of word and image in Lutheran homiletics. Jumping, though, to closer to, into the early 19th century, I would argue that on the basis of, once again, tract imagery, American Protestants had no problem with images. Especially they had no problem with images, or we might argue particularly, when they were linked to texts. Protestants like words. They like theology. Some of them like creeds. They're quite fond of dogmas and doctrines, and if you're a Protestant, it means you stand for this particular set of doctrines, and you can articulate that. And that's the way Protestants are often formed in Sunday schools and Bible camps, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what they found was, in the early 19th century, as lots of new immigrants were coming to the States, that there was a need to, a perceived Protestant need, to educate people about Jesus. And this was linked to a very national program, something I'll be talking about this afternoon, where making American citizens meant Christianizing them, which meant Protestantizing, which meant evangelical Protestantizing them. There was a cultural agenda. To make America a democracy that worked, there was always this underlying anxiety about democracy. Would it work? Well, one of the ways to make sure it worked was to turn people into Christians so that they'll have moral values in place. This is a cultural argument that's in many ways still with us. And these Protestants, mostly Presbyterian and Congregationalist Protestants, found, beginning in the 1820s and moving from there, that illustrated tracts were very popularly received. People liked them. They liked to look at them. Kids liked them. They used them as rewards at Sunday school. They used them when they pass them out in the street. Come to church on Sunday, come to Sunday school. They were very attractive and they worked. And American Protestants found that you could take the image and key it to the text. Typically, as you can see here, the first thing you see on the page is the crucifixion image. There's a text to go with it, and then a reference, where to go in the text to read more. So image and text are interwoven, interlocked into a kind of uniform a presentation. I talked about Catholics, too, and they are arriving in the United States in the 1830s and 40s in unprecedented numbers. cities like Boston that had been traditionally very Protestant became Catholic cities. Cincinnati, many cities, not just in the Northeast, but throughout the states, became very attractive because they were industrial centers. Two Catholics from across Europe arriving as new immigrants. And enterprising business people like Nathaniel Currier, who was already working in the 30s, 1830s, as a lithographer, produced images that would appeal to these newcomers. So I'm showing you a couple of these that he produced from the 1840s. And he was careful to provide English, but also French and Spanish, sometimes Italian, sometimes German, in the captions so that these would be products that any number of new Catholic Americans would find appealing and useful. We get the 14 Stations of the Cross, the road to the Holy Cross here, with French on the top and English on the bottom. These were images that people hung in the homes. They would be used perhaps in Sunday schools or in instructional settings. They were inexpensive, hand-painted objects, mass-produced, sold on the streets, sold in stores. They were a lucrative, flexible commodity that was commercially rewarding for Currier and for many of his competitors. And they were the largest single source of Catholic images available in the marketplace. Well, his commercial success, Nathaniel Currier's commercial success at selling to Catholics in Canada and throughout the United States, even in the southwestern United States among Latino Catholics, encouraged him to exploit the Protestant market. And he is perhaps more than any other single image maker, mass-produced image maker in the 19th century, responsible for crossover, for commercial crossovers. He took Catholic stuff, modified it, and found that it worked among Protestants. He had to make some careful adjustments. For instance, when he does, one of his competitors, the firm of Kellogg and Thayer, based in Hartford, Connecticut, did the Lord's Prayer. They add the Protestant version that ends differently than the Catholic version in order to appeal to a Protestant market. And they take Currier and Ives produced. Ives joined the firm in the mid-1850s. Currier and Ives took a traditional Catholic portrait of Jesus. It's supposedly based on a contemporary description by a guy named Publius Lentulus, who wrote the Senate in Rome about this guy Jesus of Nazareth, and described his face, which comports very nicely with the tradition of showing his appearance. So people felt, well, yeah, this must be the real thing. That appealed to Protestants. They liked the idea of matching text and image. So this image sold to Protestants. And they like the fact that you were looking at the true portrait. You're not seeing some artist's conception. You're seeing something that has, they believed, historical documentation. There's a letter that goes with it. There's an eyewitness that goes with it. It appeals to the sort of Protestant empirical imagination. It's a sure thing. You can get your hands on it. It's right there. It's got history behind it. So that was a very good example of a crossover visual commodity. Children and mothers became special objects of Protestant and Catholic affection in the 19th century because of the shift in social arrangements. As factories formed and mills and the labor force shifted from the rural to the city, the urban regions, the practice of fathers working at home, as they had done in the colonial period in the 18th century, shifted to fathers working away from home. And that left mom in charge of the home. She became the principal spiritual guru, really, of the children. She read scripture to them. She taught them. She taught them morality and values and a huge literature to help mothers do that, formed in antebellum America. And Jesus acquires in 19th century imagery a special fondness for children. So you see images like this start to become very popular of Jesus with the children, and he looks rather meanly at the disciples who, the story goes, wanted to intervene. That's something that certainly that iconography pre-existed the 19th century, but you find it with increasing frequency in the early 19th century in order to show, to emphasize Jesus' fondness for children. This becomes especially important. This subject matter, one art historian has, I think, conclusively demonstrated, did not pre-exist the Reformation. So what you're looking at is an originally Protestant idea, now mass-produced in America to endorse and promote a new practical theology called child nurture. A lot of theologians were arguing that we need to pay a lot more attention to our kids because they are the future, because in fact they are not little adults. They can be shaped from birth to become Christians. They don't have to wait till they become adults to convert. Christianity is happening in the bedroom of the child already, and mothers in particular need to be sensitive to this to form kids over their youth. So we get the Victorian mother enthroned in the home with her children. We get guardian angels who are really just Victorian mothers with wings attached. Mothers are sacralized, they are elevated, they are seen as angels walking the earth. The guardian angel is almost always shown as female. She's a higher version of mortal women. Is a new popular iconography endorsing home culture as the real center of American Christianity. This is a primer produced by the American Tract Society in 1863, and what I'm showing you is the title page and across from it the frontispiece. So this is, as you open the book, this is what you see. And I was quite struck by, we get here the modern mother doing what mothers do in the Victorian home, using an American Tract Society product. Here you get some product endorsement, reading to the kids and teaching them. Across the page you get the ancient mother, Jesus, doing the same thing. So Jesus becomes more like mother, mother becomes more like Jesus. These categories begin to intermingle. And that's what, of course, sets us up for the remasculinization happening later. There are, however, competing models of what women are in the 19th century. It's important. I can't go into that in much detail, but it's important to acknowledge that the Victorian, the mother, the Christian mother, is just one that emerges. There is, however, the more radical imagination of the American woman, the one who takes a stronger, more public stand against various what were perceived as various public abuses, such as the consumption of alcohol. The Victorian mother, what was often called the, or what historians have come to call the Republican mother, is the woman who stays at home. Her proper sphere is the home, where she takes care of children. And much of the Protestant iconography dedicated to this home culture, home child nurture, shows her in the home, as I've pointed out, doing what mothers do, according to that ideology. This version was embraced by many Christian Protestant women. It was issued in the year that the Women's Christian Temperance Union was formed. It was a group of women who were committed to entering the public sphere and shaking it up. Some women associated with this group argued for women's suffrage, argued that women should get the vote. Didn't happen for a while. But there were, the point is, a number of women who were exploring, still Christian, still publicly Christian, still engaged in public Christian campaigns, who were, however, exploring different ways of being a woman in America that sought to leave behind, or at least temper, the older Victorian model of mom at home. To look at another aspect of Protestant visual piety in the 19th century, I want to return to this perception that's still around, in fact, that Protestants just don't do images, that other folks do those. What's really fascinating about 19th century responses to paintings like this one by a Hungarian painter, Mihály Munkácsy, Christ Before Pilate, was produced, exhibited in Paris and London, and then finally came to New York, went to Philadelphia, where it was bought by John Wanamaker, the department store magnate, and then installed in his chief department store there in Philadelphia. He was an active Methodist evangelical Christian. What's fascinating about this is we have lots of newspaper accounts and letters, diaries of people who went to see this. And we know how they reacted to it. And it's extremely interesting because it sort of bends our idea about how Protestants make use of images. It was shown in the 23rd Street Tabernacle, which is no longer there in the south end of Manhattan. And it was a space dedicated to public presentations, theatrical presentations, also sometimes religious worship, civic occasions. And it was a large arena-style kind of theatrical space. And this was placed on the stage. It's a very large painting, I think larger than, wider than 12 feet. So the figures are, if not life-size, close to life-size, at least Jesus and Pontius Pilate in the foreground are. And people went to this and were stunned. They were struck dumb. They wrote about this as being present at the event itself. They said it's as if the curtains of history have parted, using that theatrical metaphor, in this theatrical space, and we are seeing the real thing. They talk about this real presence, about the kind of hushed, venerating response that they have to this. These are all Protestants. These are Episcopalians. These are a few Lutherans, several Baptists, a lot of Presbyterians and Congregationalist Christians, who really aren't used to looking at this kind of an image, but they're bowled over by it. They're stunned, as I said. They love this. And when I first read this a few years ago, it really was counterintuitive to me. But then as I started looking around, I started reading accounts of traveling panoramas of the New Testament or of the Book of Revelation. And I dug into news accounts of how people in Chattanooga or in Annapolis responded to these panoramas and traveling images like this. I saw a large pattern taking shape. And in fact, Protestants have in the 19th century had a thirst for the real thing. They wanted to see it. They wanted to be there. They wanted to witness it. They talk about these as a tableau vivant, that is, a living image. You're not. And I started to think, well, what Protestants are really doing here is, in their own minds, they're not looking at an image. They're looking at what they think is a real thing, a tableau vivant, a living picture. It's as if they want to efface the painted surface and make of it a window through which they look and apprehend the thing itself. Protestants are, of course, conservative Protestants, affirm the historical veracity of the New Testament. It's not fiction, it's not myth, it's not made up in any way. It is real. What you read on the page is literally true. This is the way evangelical Protestants today still speak of the New Testament. And this image, for many of them, matched their experience of text. So once again, we see textual sensibilities exported to the image to modify it, to make of it something, I would argue ultimately, that the text itself can't do as well. So Protestants are very resourceful in how they knit together words and images. And they are, always have been, very friendly to new media. Really, Luther, the Reformation wouldn't have happened without the printing press. It would have been dead in the water. He exploited this new technology. John Calvin exploited that technology to the nth degree to make that cultural revolution work. Well, the pattern, the technology-friendly pattern of thinking prevailed throughout the history of Protestantism into our own day. And we see Protestants using new media as soon as it appears in the marketplace. Lantern slides, film, panoramas, stereographic photography, daguerreotypes, anything that's new, they're saying, hey, you know, I see potential in that. That can preach the word. That can work. American Protestants are forever preoccupied with the state of the nation. They're always afraid that it's going to wheel off into chaos, tip into hell. We've got to get involved. We've got to see that this doesn't happen. It requires our efforts. So they use visual technology as a way to address that need. What I'm showing you here are hand-colored lantern slides. These are 3x4, 4x4 etched glass slides of the famous South German passion play that's been going on for a couple few centuries at Oper Ammergau, every 10 years or so. And these images come from the 1900 version, which was attended by many Americans. In 1890, many Americans, we know from letters, got on the boat and went over just for that event. Protestant Americans as well as Catholic Americans, and bought sets of these when they got back. There was a kind of a sideline and taking these on the road, doing road shows, stereopticon presentations of this event. Once again, what we're seeing is a kind of visual tutelage, a visual education of American Protestants. They're not against images. They just have to be properly used. And what they loved about the Passion Play was it was so nicely narrative. It was set up in these discrete visual units that gave you the whole story. And it gave you the story with full bathrobe pageantry, with color. And I've been doing work on people who staged these at local clubs and schools and churches in the United States around the turn of the century. And they have piano players there. They would often intersplice film and lantern slides, so it's a multimedia presentation. The write-ups in local papers are stupendous. People are just sort of slack-jaw. They find this sensational and overwhelming. Other kinds of visual technologies. I mentioned stereographic cards. These are the cards that you remember those little Disney things that you looked at as a kid. That 3D effect. Well, that was a technology invented in the late 1850s. Entered the U.S. market in the 1850s. And one of the most popular series was The Passion of Jesus. So these are circulating in the U.S. In the second half of the 19th century. And in 1898, a film studio, a very early studio in New York, produced on the top of a building in Manhattan, The Passion Play, which it marketed under that title because it wanted to appeal to the public taste for Oper Ammergau, for the people who went to southern Germany to see the Passion Play. There were many versions of this. I'm showing you a film still from that of Jesus entering Jerusalem, the Messiah enters Jerusalem. And what struck me as I was looking at these different film stills and the stereographs, which are much older, well, this one is produced in 1900, about the same time, but one can trace these back 20 years before, is that they're organized visually very much the same way, which is organized very much on the principle that Mihaly Munkácsy's picture from 1881 was organized, Christ before Pilate. That is, they are kind of tableau vivant. They're horizontal structures. They're very isocephalic. That is, the heads tend to be at the same level. They're constructed in such a way that they're happening on a ledge just in front of us as viewers, as if the space in which the scene is taking place is a natural and immediate extension of our space. So they're very inviting. It's as if we're there watching it happen. They are, as I say, these tableaux vivants. Protestants love them. They didn't see these as idols. They didn't see these as violating the Second Commandment because they saw through them. It's a grand irony. They're treating these, in some sense, as a kind of Protestant icon. Now, this masculinity issue, this is where the fireworks start in many ways. And it's due in part to the stupendous success, of the educational efforts of mothers in the 19th century. They were very good at what they did. The American Tract Society, the American Sunday School Union in Philadelphia, the American Bible Society, and countless other Christian publishers flooded the marketplace with advice books, help literature, with Bibles, with tracts, with Sunday school curricula, all kinds of resources for these mothers to use in the home. We see the same thing happening today with the Christian Booksellers Association. Go to a Christian bookstore and you just find dozens and dozens of aisles of stuff, of videos and CDs and DVDs and all kinds of things. Protestants still very technology friendly, very media savvy and media friendly. Well, the success of that, both in the home and in the larger commercial reality, the business success of it, and the success of seeing Jesus' feminine side, seeing him as a tender, intimate, caring mother sort of figure, threatened many Protestant men. American men, going way back to the colonial period, have never gone to church. They just find it boring. You know, they don't like it. It's what women do. If you look at church records from the colonial period, you'll find that there are always more women than men. Some men hardly ever enter. Some men go for a period, maybe if it's a revival period, like the Great Awakening, they get excited, but then, you know, things change. American women have had a more abiding connection with the institution. There are probably lots of interesting sociological reasons. One reason is it's their place. You know, they get to be in charge. They get to dominate what happens in the church. They're on all the committees. You know, they get to call some shots, which they can't always do at home. There are probably lots of other reasons. They also get to be around other women. They get to have these friendships that being in some rural setting when they're, you know, locked up in the house at home, they can't enjoy as much. So we've got a kind of history of men and boys not going to church. There is, however, a rising tide of concern among many men that the nation is not going to do very well if we don't get those men folk engaged in church life. And they look to the commercial success of the Victorian mother and Jesus as mother. They look at this proliferation of media that's promoting that cause in the 1890s, first decade of the 20th century, and there is a backlash. There is an argument that develops among a number of conservative as well as liberal Protestant clergy, as well as Protestant businessmen associated with revivals, and famous revivalists, people like Billy Sunday, who was a professional baseball player turned revivalist and went on the road, focused on large cities, and would bring thousands and thousands of people out. And he is well known for his hyper-masculine antics at the pulpit, you know, getting into fistfights with the devil and beating the tar out of him and holding special meetings within his week-long revivals for men, just men. Businessman or young man or whatever, however he would parse the demographic. It was a question of directing his message to urban American men and arguing that if you don't get tough, something bad is going to happen. We're losing the fight here. And he was into rallying the troops to this masculine cause. I didn't bring any of these images along, but he, for instance, a good Protestant character, used visual media. He had snapshots taken of himself swinging at the devil, picking up the podium that he was preaching from and swinging it through the air. This is kind of a Mick Jagger, you know, pre-World War I Mick Jagger evangelical. And he had these made into postcards, and he would sell them at all his revivals. So you got to go home with a postcard of Billy Sunday beating the devil up. Others produced, one of my favorite books was produced by Bruce Barton called A Young Man's Jesus, published in 1914. And I'm showing you the frontispiece to that, painted by a guy named Darius Cobb, about whom I know absolutely nothing. He's vanished from the historical record. But this is called The Master. And I'm comparing it with an image from the most successful commercial seller, commercial Bible from the 19th century, published by the Harper brothers in 1846. And this is the Victorian Jesus. And just compare him to the new macho Jesus, the hyper-masculine Jesus. This Jesus has no shoulders. He's got big, sad eyes. He's got long sort of hair that conforms to the sort of sloping contours of his body. His body, which is really not there, it vanishes beneath this nondescript, pseudo-biblical tunic. He looks sad. He's got very cleanly, crisply defined lips. He's a precious, articulate fellow. This is a man of deep sensitivity. This is a man of deep feeling. He's been touched. He has suffered. He looks out to the viewer and wants to engage us in an act of sympathy, of common feeling. Well, when Bruce Barton and Darius Cobb looked at that, they saw a girly man. They saw some wimp. And they used those kinds of epithets. This is a sissy Jesus, they said. Bruce Barton said in his book. What kind of visual program did he want for the American church? This was it. This was the frontispiece to his book. It's Jesus as Cro-Magnon man. This is no girly man. This is sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger avant la lettre. This is a Jesus who will kick butt. This is a Jesus who will rise up to the task of the effeminization of American culture, and will reverse this emasculation, reverse that, and assert a dominant male presence in the church as an institution, as a congregation. And he talks about in his book and in another book he wrote a few years later, called "The Man Nobody Knows," i.e., Jesus. He said, "You know, you look at Sunday school rooms, and it's no wonder boys hate going there. You walk into a Sunday school room, and what do you see? You see a picture of Mary. You see a picture of Elizabeth. You see a picture of Ruth. Well, where's David? Where's all the great patriarchs, Moses and Jacob and Isaac? Where are all the men of the Bible? They're not there. So what red-blooded American young lad wants to sit in that room? It's a room for wimps and sissies. So he wanted to shift the blame away from American men to the unstated programmers of the iconography of Sunday school, that is, women who are teaching there. And he has a kind of send-up of the typical Sunday school teacher. Reminds me of the sort of delightful cliches and stereotypes you hear on Prairie Home Companion, you know, characterizing Catholics and Lutherans in Minnesota. I mean, he's a devastating writer. He's got a great eye for describing these types. And Bruce Barton went on to be one of the most successful ad men. He produced a very successful advertising business in Chicago. Actually ended up running for president at one point. So this was a guy who had a keen sensibility for the look of things and tried to shape the public perception of Jesus with this kind of imagery, which illustrated his book. He didn't succeed. At least he didn't succeed as he had wanted to. The feminine Jesus stuck around, but so did the masculine Jesus. They're both there. They're both firmly ensconced in the American imagination. And I've been intrigued to follow these two cultural scripts into the 20th century. I'm not going to talk about that very much. Really, I want to end here in a minute and hear from you, but you can see this playing out in 20th century Protestant iconography, particularly in the work of Warner Salmon, who produced this picture of Jesus and this drawing. Did the drawing in 1924, did a painting of it, which I'm sure you know much better. You see it around. It actually still hangs in YMCAs. He did a lot of work for YMCAs, and it's in a lot of church fellowship halls and Sunday school rooms. And this is interesting because I've read the accounts of people, Protestant folks, responding to him. And you get two diametrically opposed responses. On the one hand, people say, finally, a manly Jesus. This is the Jesus I know. This is my best friend. This is the Jesus that speaks to me. Salmon himself told a story, probably completely apocryphal, but told a story about talking with a faculty person at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago when he was a young man. This teacher there told him, you know, I think it's time, it's high time for a Christian man to paint Jesus as a Christian man. Enough of this silly, wimpy Jesus stuff. We've got to have a man's man. Solomon used that as a kind of authorization for his project in 1940 to produce this painted version, which went into immediate mass production and spread throughout the U.S., indeed around the world. I've seen it in Africa, it's in Asia, it's everywhere. Protestant missionaries have taken it on their own. Catholic missionaries, as well as priests and others, have used it. So it's everywhere. On the other hand, as I said, there's a different response. My favorite is this Lutheran seminary professor in 1952 said, this Jesus has just stepped out of the shower where he's used, you know, some gospel shampoo. And he talked about it as a woman with a beard. Now, I don't know if he knew it or not, but that phrase was first invented in the 1890s to describe this feminized Christ from the 19th century. It was used by the masculinist party of Protestants who wanted to wrench that picture of Jesus out of the American imagination and replace it with the macho one. A woman with a beard. I mean, that's quite fascinating. It takes us back to this 19th century practice of intermingling Jesus and mom. And I think that's ultimately what they're talking about. And I mentioned the anxiety that Bruce Barton had with the moms who taught Sunday school and covered the walls with sweet pictures of Mary and forgot about Jesus. Or Barton said, the only Jesus you'll see there is the little 12-year-old, the little boy Jesus. So you've got these two responses. And there are probably, I think, interesting reasons for those responses. You've got people who stand in either party, but then you've also got people that actually combine them, these two. I mean, when evangelicals talk about Jesus, they talk about him in very fond personal terms. They have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Jesus is my best friend. He's my pal. I can always go to him. He always listens to me. He never ignores me. I mean, that's a tender, intimate, accessible Jesus. On the other hand, the same people want to have a role model for masculinity, a Jesus who kind of models male friendship, who models a heroic, assertive male presence in American society. Solomon had a difficult task. I think he succeeded at it in many ways, though. What makes him so successful, and as I said, his work is everywhere, he was trained as a commercial artist. He would take pre-existing things like this one. This is a 19th century German painter, and he would morph it into his version. This is a late 19th century French painter, and he took his image of Jesus, you can see, from that. Made some interesting changes, but it's largely a re-articulation of that. And you look at all of his major pictures. I'm sure you've seen them, Jesus knocking at Hart's door, a lot of these. They're all updated versions of a 19th century Victorian image. Why? Well, images, I think human brains are inherently conservative mechanisms, organisms. They latch onto things and they keep them, especially things they learn early on. You know, first impressions, how strong first impressions are of someone? It's like they become indelible. They get in place and it's just really hard to get rid of them. You can do it, but you've got to work very hard. We just have this hardware, it's wetware up here that acts that way. It gloms onto things and it keeps them. And then it builds on them. It builds layer upon layer upon layer. And it looks for patterns that connect those things. And if you look at the history of image of Jesus, they tend to corroborate one another. Solomon knew that. He knew that particularly in popular piety, you don't want some avant-garde thing challenging your beliefs. You want to see the same thing. You want to see the same old thing updated, affirmed. His art is about reassurance. It's about confirming what you always knew. So he looks to the past and gives us new versions of it. This is a good example. This is from 1852, a children's newspaper showing a little girl who and her siblings here. She's brought, can't see it very well, it's a bad reproduction, but she's bringing a wounded bird to mom. This is the Victorian mother enthroned like a kind of Protestant Madonna in her domicile, caring for kids. What's what they do? Well, 100 years later, Solomon gives us his version, he careth for you, and we see Jesus in the place of mom. What's fascinating about that picture is Jesus really doesn't engage the children quite the same way. You know, he sort of looks beyond us. This is as if he really, not entirely sure he wants to be there. you've got the boy who brings the sparrow, and the girl, of course, holds her little doll, nurse doll, doing what, you know, in the ideology of this picture, doing what girls do. This girl, of course, is silent. She looks at the boy. The boy is speaking. So there's a kind of gender role thing happening here, visually articulated. But there's something about the uneasiness of Jesus that I keep coming back to as I look at this picture. And it's as if the two cultural scripts I talked about have collided. And their dis-ease with one another is getting worked out visually. There's Jesus' mother, but then there's also this Jesus' yearning for this other. And you look at the kind of bulk of Jesus here. He's painted on a different scale. The kids are almost doll-like. So it's an instance where you see the epicenter for this deep quake of these two, this American fault line on the sexual conception of Jesus. And then finally, just a really quick look at the different uses of Christ. John Muir was the guy who set up the Sierra Club, and many people said he saved the West. He saved Yosemite. Well, he's shown as a kind of Jesus figure. Abraham Lincoln is shown as a kind of Christ. We were talking about Uncle Tom here, the Freedmen's Memorial in Washington. And finally, County Cullen's Black Christ and Other Poems. This is the frontispiece that shows the suffering of the lynched American black male as a version of Christ's crucifixion. So the power of the motif of Christ is something that permeates the culture and has a great deal of cultural capital. Thank you for listening.